Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning, everybody. This is Danny Nesvedarani, your host for this hour of Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. Thank you so much for tuning in this hour, whether you're driving your car or your home or you're in the office. No matter where you are, thank you so much for tuning in to Speak Up every Mondays, Tuesdays, and Thursdays here at CJSF. And today we have a couple of pieces, but one that will span the majority of this hour, and that is an interview that I did recently with Paul Tanari. Paul Tanari is a academic. He is a also someone who is very involved in the field of futurology and future studies. In fact, he has his own show here called Future Talk, which plays, I believe, every Monday at 4 p.m. And recently we spoke with him. Paul Tanari is also Métis, and during some of his youth was involved within the residential school system and experienced a lot during that time. A lot of trauma, a lot of many atrocities, and he was willing to talk to us about that and how he grew past it and was able to come into his own despite everything that he experienced as a child. So we were really appreciative that he took the time to speak with us on the matter. And before I play the interview, I just want to give a pretty significant content warning. There are topics addressed in this interview regarding things such as sexual abuse, bodily harm, and if that is something that you don't want to listen to, then I'm letting you know now that is going to be included in the interview. So once again, this is our interview with Paul Tanari.
Hello, can you hear me?
Oh, hello. Hi, I can hear you. Can you hear me well?
Yes, I
Perfect.
Can.
Perfect. All right. Thank you so much for speaking with me today, Paul.
Yes, I'm happy to. The older residential school survivors are dying off slowly, so it's important that people who are still here just talk about this topic and make sure that it never happens again in Canadian history.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, again, I think it's really important, and I feel really grateful that you reached out to speak with me on this today, and specifically about your experiences. You know, it admittedly, you are someone whose voice I've actually heard quite often, because I work at CJSF. So, you know, every Monday afternoon, I think I hear that little bit of when you say, I think it's along the lines of, you know, if you don't plan for your own future, someone else will be more than happy to do it for you.
That's right. That's very, very good saying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just like if you don't do politics, politics will be done to you.
Mm-hmm, exactly. So I guess the first question I'd want to ask you about just, you know, this interview and your experiences is, what made you reach out and help organize this?
Well, a number of years ago, there was a nun that I knew at the residential school who was actually one of the really nice nuns. They weren't all abusive. Some were very, very nice. Some really tried to protect us from the priests. So I want to make that clear, that this is not a blanket condemnation of an entire group of people. there were very good nuns and there were evil ones. So I want to make that clear. Similarly, there were priests who objected to the abuse that was being done, but they were usually junior priests and they were told to shut up. So not all the priests were abusive. I want to make that very clear. So what made me reach out is that one of the nuns I really liked, she came forward at great personal risk to start to talk about what was happening within this residential school, that nuns were getting raped, students were getting abused, and so on. And so I figured if she was willing to risk her pension, her position in the church, because probably the church would have suspended her, cut off her pension, kicked her out of the old folks home she was in. So she took all those risks in order to tell the truth. So I figured I should come forward as well. And I started to talk about this many, many years ago. I started to organize with some of the elders a compensation for the residential school students. And that was settled under Harper for $3.2 billion. So that was a big step forward. 14,000 students were compensated, and that was a good step forward. And now we're at another generation of people who may not have heard of the residential school, so that's why I continue to talk about it, so that people know what happened and that I can be someone who gives testimony to what happened as one of a ever diminishing number of people who's still alive to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in stating that, I think, you know, one thing that's important to acknowledge too, is that it's not something that is so distant in the past, you know, like what year specifically were you within that system?
I was in the system from around 1961, 62 to about 1964, 65, around that area. So the last residential school was in Saskatchewan and closed in 73. So that's within the memory of a lot of people still alive today. But the residential school system was set up in the 1800s, and the goal, this was their words, not mine. The goal was to get the Indian out of the Indian. That's exactly how they termed it. So natives were no longer allowed to speak their language, or practice any of their religious ceremonies, honor their culture in any way. So essentially to make them white, that was the goal. And my particular school chosen to be for mixed blood people as myself. So my grandfather was Abenaki, and my other ancestors were French Canadian and Scandinavian. One parent white, one parent a native, or a grandparents native, so on. However, the picture was the same, that my mother was widowed at a very young age, two jobs, and I was a latchkey kid. So social services decided that you couldn't take care of me. So they came and scooped me up and put me into this school. And so there was no voluntariness about it. It was a government sanctioned action. And this happened to thousands of kids in the 1800s and 1900s. So the effort was made to blank out my native culture. Like, I spent time on my grandfather's native reserve, and I learned to speak Abenaki, and I practiced many of the ceremonies, for example, the vision quest and so on. Their goal was to eliminate all that aspect of my personality to essentially make me like a white kid. So I'm able to see the world from both perspectives. Being mixed blood, I can see the world from the white perspective and the native perspective. When I did my vision quest, my vision was of a wolverine bounding over deep snow. And my grandfather, who was a shaman, interpreted that I would be a link between the native culture and the white culture, which is what I've always worked hard to do my whole life, to work with both Native and white in reconciliation and to help Natives wherever possible. So, for example, recently I've been working on a 3D printing, concrete house printing technology. I want to bring good quality housing to Native reserves and solve the Native housing crisis. So that's how I'm contributing to that with my my education.
Yeah, I that's kind of sounds like it's sort of in line with the your futurist background in a sense. Does I guess that sort of intersect or connect in any way?
Yes. I was really, really lucky that I was able to get scholarships to go to university. So I got an engineering degree, and I'm using it, as I said, to solve the Native housing crisis. So I'm doing a lot of projects with Native. Like, for example, with Haida Gwaii, I'm working to develop an ocean current tidal technology that will eliminate all the diesel generators on the island and provide clean, emission-free power. And I've been working with the Inuit up at Iqaluit, and providing ocean current energy and other advances there. So that's been a big major preoccupation of me to help Native and Inuit enter the 21st century proudly and as full participants.
Mm-hmm. You know, another question I had for you is someone who had to go through those specific experiences, and you know, you've talked about it before in the past, the specific, frankly horrifying actions that you had to endure.
Yeah, I'm willing to talk about some of them. A common punishment was to lock us into a dark cupboard closet, I guess you call it, like pitch black with no food, no water. That was a very common punishment. One of the real evil nuns, our nickname for her was Attila the Nun. she loved grabbing us by the ear and pulling us along by our ear, and that actually damaged some people's hearing. That's not a very good way to treat students. And the most insidious thing was, I don't think that most natives are not aware of this, but historically, the most sacred part of the male body was considered to be the foreskin. So therefore, when giving sacrifices to the Great Spirit, a man would pierce his foreskin and offer the blood, the droplets of blood, to the Great Spirit. Now, the missionaries knew this, and so therefore, they were great advocates of circumcision so that you literally could not practice your religion. They literally took away the part of your body that was used for making a sacrifice. So it's a really insidious thing. I was the first person to go public with it, and my case was actually covered by the CBC National News. So you can enter my name, Paul Tenery Circumcision, and you'll see National News many, many years ago. I think I was in my 40s then, they covered it on the National News. So that's still available online. You can go to YouTube and see that. And I spoke about the beatings. You know, there was one person who had been in the military before he became a priest, and we called him Colonel Kane because he always walked around with the bottom part of a fishing rod and would beat us with that, and it left incredibly deep bruises in the part of the body that was hit. He was very sadistic. And what this shows is that when people have absolute power, that with no accountability, that this type of evil is propagated. And this is, I believe, universal. Anyone given absolute power, whether they be German or Cambodian or Vietnamese or American or whatever, anyone has absolute power will often abuse that power. Was it Lord Acton who said, Do you remember the statement by Lord Acton about absolute power? Oh, yeah. Power corrupts, then absolute power corrupts absolutely. There it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's why they were accountable to no one. They had absolute monopoly on power within the residential school. And that's why the evil was propagated. But let me repeat, there were some people, many people actually, within the system who tried to protect us, who actually told the priest to back down because they found what they were doing was inhuman. And I want to stress that. I want to compliment those people who, at great risk to themselves, tried to protect us. Now, some of the nuns were not there voluntarily. Like, for example, in Quebec at the time, if a boyfriend didn't like, they would force her to become a nun. She had no choice. So a lot of those women were miserable there. It's important to stress that. This was a seething cauldron of emotion. The students didn't want to be there. Many of the nuns didn't want to be there because of risk to myself. But now that most of the people are dead, I feel free to talk about it. The residential school where I was originally a convent that had been converted to a residential school. So many, many nuns lived there. Anyway, the priest turned it into like a bordello. They would actually invite political figures to come and have sex with the nuns. And I witnessed that myself. So many political figures of the time who are now dead would come to have sex with the nuns and the priest would collect the money. So there was a horrible human trafficking going on in the school. So it wasn't just the natives who were being victimized. It was also many of the nuns. So I wanted to expose that for what I witnessed at the time. However, many of these people were powerful people, and I didn't want to risk my whole career and everything by exposing them at the time. You're familiar with the Epstein situation, right?
Yes, yes.
Okay, well, there was a woman who came forward as one of the victims of Epstein, and she knew the very powerful political figures who had been clients of Epstein and gone to his island. She witnessed them. Anyway, they were petrified that she would testify about what had happened. And she escaped to the outback of Australia to get as far away as she possibly could. And they tracked her down and killed her there. So you can see. So I realized that I would be compromising my mission to help natives if I got assassinated. So I kept quiet about what I just told you about the political figures. We're talking about Quebec Parliament, high-level politicians who were using this service provided by the residential school.
Wow. Just, you know, I think it's fair to say that you have seen some of just the worst in humanity and have experienced and witnessed so much cruelty.
The next question I wanted to ask you is what advice you would give to Indigenous and Native youth that may currently be going through, well, you know, different struggles, still ones that stem from sort of historical legislative reasons and origins.
So getting to the question you said, and that is that in order to understand trauma, to understand it at a great depth, I've studied other groups that have been subjected to trauma, for example, Holocaust survivors. So my mentor when I was growing up was a man called Mr. Goldstein, and he had been a carpenter in Auschwitz. And I learned a lot from him how to deal with trauma. So, I mean, as you can imagine, a concentration camp has certain similarities to residential school, but to a far greater extreme. And he survived because he made a number of decisions And this is the first point of dealing with trauma. You have to make a decision. So you've heard people say, oh, I want to lose weight, but they never do because they're saying, I'm going to try to lose weight, right? Mm-hmm. They don't make a decision. No matter what happens, I will lose weight. I will do everything to that goal. That's the decision you have to make. So if you are a native suffering from trauma, you have to make a decision. From this point forward, I will do everything to lead the best possible life I can and do as many positive things as I can to help others, as well as helping myself to lead a good life and make life better for future generations of natives. That's a decision I made after my vision quest, and I've kept doing it my whole life. So it sounds really simple, but it's amazing the number of people who never make a decision. So what are the decisions people can make? I will not abuse alcohol. I will never smoke. I will not abuse drugs. These are decisions you make, not, oh, I will try not to smoke, or I'll try to reduce my alcohol consumption. No, that's not a decision. So you can lie to other people, but you can't lie to yourself. There's the first step. The next step is to go to experts in trauma and receive trauma counseling. I had a psychiatrist who worked with me for many, many years, and he was outstanding. He was excellent. And so he helped me direct my path, and he strongly encouraged me to gain closure by joining elders in launching a lawsuit, a class action lawsuit against the federal government, because essentially the federal government was enabling these residential schools in with the help of the provincial governments, right? So this was settled after, it took us 30 years of work. So these things don't happen quickly. So persistence is a number one priority here. Persistence, never give up. You establish your goal, you made firm decisions, and then you pursue that goal like a dog hanging on to a bone. You don't let it go. And no matter how many defeats you have, no matter how many no's you hear, you keep going and moving forward and gaining allies and working towards that goal. It took us 30 years, but under Harper, we got a $3.2 billion settlement for 14,000 residential school survivors. Great victory. Now, on the reservations, there's a battle going on between the traditional chiefs, who want to keep everything the way it was, and elected chiefs who want to move natives into the 21st century. Okay, so there was a very good movie about the confrontation between whites and natives. It's called Little Big Man. Great movie. Anyway, so the chief in that movie, who was a Canadian actor, by the way, said, whatever you can say about the white man, at least we can all agree we can't get rid of them. So they are here, and we have to live together in harmony. That is the goal. So to that end, natives must move into the 21st century, keeping their religious beliefs, keeping their ceremonies, reverse what the missionaries tried to do, eliminate the Indian within the Indian, re-establish ceremonies that were banned, the potlatch, the ghost dance, all these other ceremonies that were banned should be restarted, reinitiated. I've helped work with Native groups about establishing vision quests, again, a vital part of growing up in Native culture, absolutely vital. It gave me all the energy I have today. So that's why the missionaries banned it, because it was such an important part of Native culture. During the 1800s, many Native groups were given the worst agricultural land there was, the most barren, dry, unproductive land, because agriculture was seen as the most productive activity in the 1800s. So many groups in Alberta are now sitting on the richest land with oil and coal and potlatch deposits. So there are tribes now in Alberta, I understand, where when a young Native individual turns 18, he's given a check for $1 million. So it's certainly a way to get the last laugh against the white man, isn't it? And anyway, so the important thing is that natives in that situation, and there's going to be increasing numbers of them as native groups develop their resources, It's important that Native groups be taught the basics of money management, because it's very hard to handle large amounts of money if you don't have no idea what to do with it, right? So you don't gamble it away or spend it on illicit drugs and so on. So learn investment strategies, learn how to buy and sell stocks, how to invest in real estate and so on. So it's important that these skills be imparted to young natives, and that will help heal the trauma of past, where the depression that fell onto native groups in the 1800s was total. You were told that your religion was garbage. You were told your culture was useless. So how could you not become an alcoholic under those conditions, right? So you have to reestablish pride in your culture, pride in your language, pride in who you are. You are a valid Canadian participant in Canadian culture as well as your own and Canadian economy, and you will prosper under those conditions. So that the important thing here is to realize that trauma is not a permanent condition. Many children of Holocaust survivors have had to go for counseling because trauma can be inherited. Even the grandchildren of Holocaust survivors find that the trauma passes on through the generations, and it is treatable. That's the good news. That go for qualified professional help and have a firm decision behind you to make something of your life positive and to develop yourself into the goals that you establish for yourself. You have to have firm goals. It doesn't matter what they are. I want to be a lawyer. I want to be a doctor. I want to be a shaman. Whatever it is, have a firm goal and work diligently to achieving it. I just like to say some of the profound lessons I learned very briefly. I just want, you know, the highlights of my life, or the lessons I learned. So when I was 5 years old, in those days, it's hard to believe today, but in my day, when I was 5 years old, wandered all over the neighborhood. It was pretty safe. It's strange. You would never let a five-year-old wander around, you know, Toronto today. But in those days, sort of semi-rural area, five-year-olds went to each other's homes and parents didn't worry. Anyway, there was a blind guy who lived a few houses down from us. He had been blinded in Normandy. I was walking by his house and he said, "Oh, you must be Edward's boy." I go, "Yeah, I am." He could tell who people were by their footsteps. He said, "Well, come over. We haven't had a chat yet." And so I saw that he was blind, and I'd never seen a blind person before. And I said, it must be terrible to live in darkness. And you know what he said? He said, "Fear is the only darkness." So I never forgot that. So try and live your life without fear. Most people are paralyzed by fear. Fear of failure, fear of success, fear of being too thin, fear of being too fat, fear of being too tall, too short, whatever. I mean, on the reservation, I was teased because my Scandinavian ancestry may be quite light compared to my friends, and so they called me Mr. Vanilla. Well, you just take it. Yeah, everyone's going to be called names at some point in life. Just take it. It was not my fault, right? I'm still proud of my heritage. Anyway, that was my first lesson. And if I've achieved anything in my life, it's because of a lack of fear. And yeah, I've had failures, but who cares? You learn from it. Anyway, another real valuable lesson I learned was from my grandfather, who was an Abenaki shaman. And he said many things, but there was one particular thing he said. He said that things do not happen to you, they happen for you. So think about that. So think of all the unfairness in your life, the trauma or whatever, these have not happened to you. They've happened to make you a better person.